the only thing new that's come along since the 1930s is technocracy. And that's, you know, we see this, the policies being worked out in sustainable development and climate change and so on today. The patterns are unmistakable.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. This conversation is being recorded on the 12th of November, 2015, here in Japan. And today we are talking once again to Patrick Wood, the author of Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation at technocracyrising.com. You will remember him from a previous interview that we had on the subject of technocracy. He is also keeping track of a lot of technocracy-related news at technocracy.news, and he is also the host of a brand new Technocracy Rising Hour, Monday to Friday at 7 to 8 p.m. Pacific on the Talk Network at talknetwork.com. All of that will be linked up in the show notes for this interview, so you can follow his work directly. Patrick Wood, it sounds like you have been very busy in the last few months getting these things up and going.
James, you have to strike while the iron is hot. That's all I can say. There's no time to be, lounging back on the couch.
Well, no, there really isn't, because this really is a game for all the marbles, and we are in the end stages of that game. And unfortunately, that is coming to a head very, very soon with a very important conference that is about to get underway, which is the main topic for us today. And I'll take this from an editorial I wrote recently at technocracy.news, The Irrational War on Carbon, toward the 2015 Climate Change Summit in Paris, which starts by noting, the core stakeholders who will orchestrate the Paris 2015 Climate Change Summit are out in full force to froth the brew of anti-carbon rhetoric. There is no better example of what will be said than what has already been said by the Carbon Tracker Initiative based in London. First, they call for a carbon bubble deflation, where the excessive production of fossil fuel carbon will be methodically reduced to zero thanks to financial pressure and asset realignment. Comparing carbon to a financial bubble serves to create an urgent avoidance, but the analogy is deeply flawed. According to this approach, smart utilities and other fossil fuel users are told that they should divest themselves of assets related to coal, oil, and their derivatives. Carbon Tracker then reminds the company that if management winds up the abandoned assets in their portfolio, they will have failed their shareholders. And I'll leave that for people to continue reading through that editorial again up at technocracy.news. But let's break this down for people. First of all, I suppose we should address, what is this Paris Climate Change Conference coming up, and how is this playing into the unfolding of the technocracy agenda?
There's been a rapid succession of events at the UN in this last quarter. Starting on September 25, we had the so-called 2030 Agenda Conference in New York City. That's the one that Pope Francis came to give the keynote speech. That meeting solidified an agenda. They call it 2030 Agenda. 180 nations of the world signed onto it. It proposed a number of goals and a number of principles to get there, milestones to get there. And this replaced the Millennium Development Goals that the United Nations had created back in the year 2000. The Millennium Development Goals were only good for 15 years, and they were expiring at the end of this year. So the United Nations had to do something to extend that those goals. Now they call them, these new goals, they call them the Sustainable Development Goals. But that was the primary purpose of this meeting, was to reestablish and kind of supercharge the original MDGs. And they'll go into effect, the ones they signed off on, they'll go into effect on the 1st of January, 2016. In the meantime, we have this climate change summit in Paris, France, that's coming up on November 30, just a few days away from now, as a matter of fact. It'll run until December 11. At this meeting, which will be chaired by the head of climate change at the UN, Christiana Figueres, this meeting will determine an action plan to figure out or to target how to actually create or make these sustainable development goals come to pass. It's radical. It's over the top. That's my opinion in any case. It's over the top. And if they are able to sign off, and there's risk in this, but if they're able to get the nations of the world to sign off with this, the world is going to radically change within the next 10 years, just unquestionably so. There's risk in it, however. I personally believe that Christiana Figueres is sweating a little bit right now because her climate change argument is falling apart right in front of her face. Secondly, there's several nations around the world that are throwing up big question marks. You know, they're thinking, we've been really screwed before. You know, this is about the fourth time. I wonder if this is going to be good for us. And they're asking some stiff questions like, who's going to pay for this in particular? And how's it going to affect us?
Well, that's the important question, because unfortunately, again, this all does come back down to the monetary aspect of this. And I think that's what you're pointing to in this editorial talking about the war on carbon and the Carbon Tracker Initiative. Of course, we know that the idea, supposedly, is to get carbon emissions, by which, of course, we're talking about carbon dioxide. So even there, this sort of sleight of hand or sloppy language, which belies, I think, the sloppiness of the argument in general. But anyway, they're talking about a carbon bubble deflation, which puts it in a very interesting financial argument. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that and why you think this is being framed in that way at this time.
It's actually being framed in every conceivable way that you can imagine. This is one I picked up on because of my financial background. And I figured this is pretty unique, actually, on their part. And instead of just going directly after the prime ministers of the countries and so on, they're going after the financial world. They're going after the big companies. They're going after the banks. And they're going into them essentially telling them, if you don't get rid of the assets that you have that pertain to oil and coal, then later on, if what we say comes to pass, and there's no guarantee that's going to happen, but you know, this is the way they couch it. If you end up with a bunch of abandoned assets that you can't get rid of or that become worthless, you're going to have a liability to your shareholders because you haven't managed the company correctly, and you could be prosecuted for mismanagement and have personal liability. This is actually what they're saying to them. This is incredible. This is like the mob almost, you know. It's almost like extortion. But companies are buying into it. You know, oh yeah, man, I don't want to be held liable for anything. You know, better go along with this program. So they're getting companies to sell off their assets. They're going after utilities especially, but even, you know, investment companies, hedge funds, you name it. They're mounting a massive divestment program.
But who's buying? That's really the question. Who's on the other side of that transaction?
Well, isn't that the truth? I have no idea who's on the other side. It's obviously going to drive properties down. And with the price of oil down where it is right now, it's like, you know, it's like a disaster already. So I don't know. But the point is, they're scaring the crud out of the corporate world, and they're getting them to go along with the program and to back sustainable development because of it. The thing that's really weird, and you read the article, I know, that the Carbon Tracker Initiative mirrors the United Nations exactly. They're lined up perfectly well. They want to reduce the extraction of coal and oil to zero by 2030. To zero. That means no more oil come out of the ground, no more coal be dug out of the ground. What's astounding to this, I can only speak for the United States right now, but 67% of our energy comes from oil and coal, period. 67%. Only 7% comes from other things like wind and solar. And so while these guys are busily making haste to destroy the brown industry, if you will, they have no viable plan to replace the energy deficit that they're creating. None. They really don't. And I thought, well, that's silly. Of course, they think they're going to build windmills all over the world or something. But Bill Gates, who is big into global warming issues right now, he said, he wrote a piece had an interview a few weeks ago, and he said, that we need more R&D. That's what we need. And the governments need to step up to the plate and put up all kinds of money and just give it to private industry. Give it to private industry. Get that part. To go out and do R&D and come up with solutions on how we can increase the alternative energy and replace this stuff. And you know what? He said, we don't have anything on the plate right now that would really do it, but he's hoping for a miracle. That's what he said. He used that word, miracle. I'm hoping for a miracle. Well, okay. They're destroying the oil industry. They're destroying the coal industry to get rid of all that bad CO2-based stuff. They're creating a huge energy deficit. If it's not filled, the world will be back in the dark ages again, literally. And they have no plan, and the best they can do is hope for a miracle. That's not a good equation.
No.
This is insanity.
Genocidal. If you cannot replace this huge, glaring energy deficit that is going to be created by this plan, there are people who will literally die from this, as there have been, for example, in recent years in the UK, people literally dying from cold winters as this entire global movement is being set up to try to stop the world from warming. It is insanity, but it is an insanity that appeals to people at a very basic level that a lot of people have signed on to. Sustainable development sounds like a good thing to a lot of people because it's phrased in this language that comes with a lot of, you know, warm, fuzzy rhetoric, and it's talking about saving the planet, and everyone knows carbon dioxide is the global thermostat for the entire globe, and it will either warm up the planet to, or we can turn that back down by getting rid of carbon. Of course, this is the kind of thinking that's been inculcated in the public, so I think we have to confront this squarely head on to show that it is not such a straightforward equation. So how do we go about even beginning to broach this subject?
You know, when I was in the first grade, one of the experiments our teacher had, she brought out a little paper cup. We didn't have styrofoam back in those days. She brought a little paper cup. We put some dirt in it, and she passed around a lima bean to every student, stuck the lima bean down in the dirt, put a little water on it. And she said, now you watch what happens. You know, we're going to follow along with it. You watch every day we're going to come in and we're going to check our little bean and see what's going on. She explained to us the whole Monty of how life works and stuff. She explained photosynthesis. She explained the life cycle, how the plants give off carbon, give off oxygen. We breathe the oxygen. We give off carbon dioxide so the plant can grow. And it was a wonderful thing. And we understood it. A first grader can understand how the world works. These people can't seem to figure this out. We need carbon dioxide. And listen, if we could do what they want to do, they would like to reduce carbon dioxide down to almost just minimal levels where there's virtually none in the atmosphere. If we did that, James, we would sterilize the Earth. Sterilize the Earth. The plants would die. The oxygen would be breathed up. And with no way to replace it, we would die. This is absolute nearsighted insanity. It's just crazy talk. Nobody has ever died out in the open, in any case, because of an overdose of carbon dioxide. That's stupid. Carbon monoxide, yes, but it's not the same. When I was a young guy in the farming industry in California, they pretty much had kind of invented the big tomato greenhouses back in those days, the hothouses, they called them. They were huge. Sometimes they're 100 yards long, a big dome-shaped buildings. First thing they would do when they put everything and all equipment in, they would put in a big fan and a CO2 concentrator at the end of the building, and they would blow enriched air, enriched with carbon dioxide, to enrich the air so the plants would grow faster. We never lost one worker, not one, ever, in those hothouses. And the fact of the matter is, if we actually would increase the level of CO2 in the world today, agricultural output would skyrocket.
Again, unfortunately, this is something that's difficult for people to understand because we have been told that it is a corporate sort of oil industry argument to argue against this. Whereas, in fact, I think the question that is never asked by these same people is who is behind the other side of this equation? Who is behind the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and the other bodies that are promoting this brand of austerity that people are seemingly embracing wholeheartedly? And I think this is something that you talk about quite effectively in Technocracy Rising. So let me just quote a passage that I think is particularly pertinent. You say, for example, the Rio Declaration, talking about the Rio Earth Summit Conference in 1992, also produced three legally binding agreements that were open for signature by participating nations. First, there was the Convention on Biological Diversity that covered ecosystems, species, and genetic resources, and that ultimately produced the massive 1,140-page Global Biodiversity Assessment document. Second, there was the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which, of course, is the body governing the COP conference of the parties that's coming up in Paris. And third, there was the United Nations Conventions to Combat Desertification. During the Rio conference, then-Secretary General of the UN, Boutros-Boutros-Ghali, also called for the creation of the Earth Charter, which was later completed and published on June 29th, 2000. And it has such warm, fuzzy rhetoric as, "We stand at a critical moment in Earth's history, a time when humanity must choose its future," and other such dramatic language. And you go on to note, "It is not coincidental that the principal author of the Earth Charter was Stephen C. Rockefeller, the son of the former Vice President Nelson Rockefeller and nephew of David Rockefeller." And it is interesting how often these types of bodies and their pronouncements go back to the very same families that are the oil industry, the Rockefellers. There is no name that is more closely associated with the history of oil than the Rockefellers, and yet they are at the heart of the UN takeover of the planet through this carbon agenda. How do we reconcile that seeming paradox?
It has been their agenda from 1973, when the Trilateral Commission was formed, to create a new international economic order. That's what they said back then. It was all over their literature. And the only thing new that's come along since the 1930s is technocracy. And that's, you know, we see this, the policy being worked out in sustainable development and climate change and so on today. The patterns are unmistakable. People have to trust me on this for now. Read my book and you'll see why I'm saying this. The Trilateral Commission has been the action group that has brought us all this stuff that we're looking at today. They brought us Agenda 21 at the Rio conference in the first place. They brought us things like the Earth Charter. They brought us all the dialogue the rhetoric on climate change. Al Gore, for instance, the poster boy for climate change, for Pete's sake, is a member of the Trilateral Commission. So we see these people's fingerprints all over this. And it's just astounding. You say, why would they be doing this? Why technocracy? Well, technocracy is about controlling resources. They want to take the resources away from people like you and me, and even governments, and even local governments, and state governments, and federal governments. They want to take the resources away and put them into a global trust for the common good. This is a master scheme. This is the end game, if you will. We don't see it quite yet, but you can clearly see it if you look at the UN closely enough. Land and resources that have, you know, like forest, farming, oil, minerals, whatever, all these things are being locked up away from our usage in any case. And climate change is being used as the fear-mongering tool to stampede people into the only solution that's being offered, namely sustainable development. So it's a 1-2 punch. The trade treaties are coming in behind this. TPP, for instance, Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Transatlantic Investment and Trade Partnership, TTIP, coming right behind this one. Same thing. Between those two treaties, 100% of the global GDP will be accounted for. They're writing a document that will put enforcement into sustainable development, and we will have no choice. And so, you know, why are they doing it? Well, once they get control of the resources of the world, they will have a monopoly, literally, on everything. The Rockefeller family, going all the way back to John D., has been a monopolistic company. And I believe it was John D. that said that competition is a sin. So, you know, we see this, you know, this philosophy has never changed. Did they control the oil? Yes, they did. Did they have a monopoly at one time? Absolutely so. Do they have a monopoly today? Not exactly. There's several companies in the energy business around the world that don't give them monopoly power. But if sustainable development gets kicked in, they will control all of the resources everywhere and every kind of resource, not just oil, everything.
That's right. I mean, that's such an important point. It's not about simply maintaining a control over the oil industry. The game has moved on since then. It is now about consolidation of that monopolistic power over resources generally, and perhaps the most important resource, the human resource, which of course we have been labeled as in the modern era. And on that note, you have a very chilling report up from last month. Scientists, genetically modified humans can fight climate change, where you note it was just a matter of time before eugenics met climate change. Even if it sounds like science fiction and absurd speculation, the discussion is taking place now in scientific circles. In fact, this is the ultimate application of science to the human condition. For instance, designer babies might be genetically engineered to be smaller as adults. This would proportionately reduce their carbon footprint. Or genes might be inserted to improve night vision. That would allow nighttime lighting requirements to be reduced, thus saving boatloads of energy and reducing carbon. Other such ridiculous ideas that are now being bandied about quite openly, and I note that this is something that has been, this is the sort of underlying ethos, I think, of this climate change agenda, and has been since the beginning. I did a series of reports on that several years ago at the Copenhagen Climate Conference, culminating in a report on carbon eugenics, which is exactly this type of idea. And I note that it's interesting. 10 years ago, just about 10 years ago, the BBC had a report, Human Species May Split in Two, talking about how humanity may split into two subspecies in 100,000 years' time, as predicted by H.G. Wells, an expert has said. Evolutionary theorist Oliver Curry at the London School of Economics expects a genetic upper class and a dim-witted underclass to emerge, basically talking about how the gene-rich and gene-poor will start to split into two different species as these genetic modifications start to take hold. And the BBC even has this illustration of this tall, 7 foot tall, you know, broad shouldered, you know, sort of wonderful example of what humans could be, and this squat goblin like creature standing next to him. And these are the ways that we're going to supposedly evolve into Eloys and Morlocks. It's insanity, but this is the actual vision of the future. And the strangest part of it is we are being taught to desire to be that squat goblin underclass creature because it's good for the planet. It will reduce carbon consumption.
I know. This whole genetics business, it sounds so strange that people almost just laugh it off. Oh, that's just too fantastic. It can't be possible. Well, it may not be possible, but these people are talking about it. And the only thing that I can conclude when these are serious people, these are serious scientists. These aren't left-wing nuts or whatever. I mean, these are credentialed and tenured scientists, for Pete's sake, talking about this. And all you can figure when you look at stuff like this is that the inmates have escaped and taken over the asylum. They're, you know, they look straight, they wear suits and ties, they have their white coat, whatever. They talk with, you know, four-syllable words. And they, you know, they have a very serious expression on their face. If you look at it close enough, you realize they're really the inmates in this mess, you know? They're just crazier than March hares. But, you know, how they cannot confront these things is beyond me, other than just say they're out of touch with reality. It's just like, how can the carbon
Tracker Initiative?
The Carbon Tracker Initiative. You know, how can they, in all good conscience, kill off the oil and coal industry and have no replacement whatsoever to make up the energy deficit? How can they do that? I mean, nobody would do such a thing. It's just absolutely nuts. And yet, there they are doing it. You look at it, yes, they are doing it. That's what they're saying.
Well, I guess the other aspects of what's coming up immediately at this Paris conference are the climate tribunal, which apparently is part of the wording of the draft treaty of the text that they're working on right now. And also the suggestion, as has been floated for years and has been recently renewed by Bill Gates and others, is, of course, we need a carbon tax. And this steps in line with another part of the technocracy agenda that you've noted, the introduction of global taxation just one step away, using the furor over corporate tax loopholes to try to garner support for a UN-administered or other international-administered taxation grid. And the carbon tax could be one foot in the door for the beginnings of that, the thin edge of the wedge, as it were. Tell us about that agenda.
Absolutely. The United Nations has been trying to get an autonomous source of income for 20 years at least, and they've tried kind of a frontal approach many times, but the way it looks like a global tax is going to be acceptable to everyone is everybody's pointing a finger at the global corporations who are evading taxes. by moving assets around from Ireland to, you know, Holland, and I don't understand the whole thing myself, but, you know, offshore countries like the Cayman Islands and so on, they're able to move money around and avoid taxes in every country. And so, you know, countries that impose taxes are getting sick of this, but they can't touch them. They can't, you know, America can't go to Ireland and do anything. You know, it's their own country. But if a global tax is proposed now to stop this, and everybody in the world is taxed, I mean, there you go. You got it. It's in the bag. And they're working on it right now to figure out a way to do it. And if they do it for the major corporations, essentially it's going to be for everybody else as well. The cat will be out of the bag at that point.
Unfortunately, that is the point, I think. Of course, yes, everyone's angry at these corporations that seem to skirt the grid. But of course, that just means they're going to tighten the noose around everyone's neck. Oh, don't throw us into the briar patch. Yes, again, it's about consolidation of power, and the only way to do that is to get popular support for that. So again, it's about fostering this popular support.
Yes, and it's the same thing with trying to get cash out of society right now, too. There's big talk amongst the big banking institutions to eradicate cash altogether and have everybody go digital. That, in my opinion, that would be catastrophic for a whole section of society worldwide, but you know, they're talking about it, and serious people, the big banks like the Goldman Sachs and the Deutsche Banks and, Bank of England, they're all talking about cashless society right now. They, you know, push everybody into the system. And the excuse they're using for this is, well, you know, there's people out there laundering drug money. And they're using cash to do it. Well, we can't have that. You know, it's like, excuse me, I mean, how much of the world trade that, you know, has to do with drugs. I mean, maybe it's a lot, but, you know, let them do business with credit cards if they have to. But, you know, to use that as an excuse to take cash out of society everywhere is insane.
Well, yes. I mean, especially since the CIA has been implicated in drug running over and over and over for decades now. And even officially the Senate has admitted the CIA was involved in drug running in the 80s. And that was from a Senate report chaired by John Kerry in the 1990s. So there you go. It's not even a conspiracy theory at this point, but so one wonders how they'll get around that in the digital currency grid. But yes, the point is well taken. Again, get the outrage going around an issue that a lot of people can agree about, and then implement the solution which will consolidate control.
Exactly. Maybe they use Bitcoin.
Probably so. Well, and
we'll
there
get,
you go.
We'll get stuck with the globalist currency. And the illegal drug running, people will turn to Bitcoin.
Yes, probably right. All right. Yeah. Well, I guess there are so many different aspects of this it's difficult to hit, but are there any other main points about the COP conference in particular you want to hit on before we go?
I think there's a risk of the meeting flying apart. And maybe it's a small risk, but people should watch that. It'd be well worth listening to some of the sessions and maybe reading some of the articles from English-speaking newspapers in Europe to see if there's any stress, any fractures within the membership of the United Nations. I think there could be real trouble this year. But I'm not making a forecast. I'm just saying I think there could be. The United Nations has had experiences in the past where meetings absolutely melted down and people stomped out. And it was a huge, huge mess on their hands. This sort of thing could happen again. I hope it does. It would be wonderful if it did. But Christiana Figueres herself recently said that if we don't pull it off in Paris this winter, it'll take us 10 to 15 years to rebuild momentum to get back to where we are today. She said that, actually. I heard her on a press conference or a speech she gave. So she's worried. You know, she's worried that they might not get it done. And that's why they're pushing so hard. That's why you see so many articles coming out everywhere about this, that this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Everybody needs to get on board with it. They're not just speaking to you and me. They're speaking to the corporate culture. They're speaking to the PMs of the world, you know, to get their act together. Hey, guys, come on here and sign off on this thing. Let's do it. And so there's a full court press going on to try and, you know, it's a pep rally in the media, if you will, a pep rally to get people to sign on to this whole thing. But I think there's a lot of skeptics out there right now. honestly.
I think there are, and poll after poll continues to show that climate change is far down the list of priorities, even for people who do believe that that this is a catastrophic event that's coming down the line. So that should show something of the fact that this has been derailed. I think I haven't seen the energy around a conference of the party, a conference like this, since Copenhagen in 2009, which did melt down, was derailed. So hopefully it can happen again, but this is one of those things that's so institutional and broad and so detached from our everyday sphere of influence. What can the average person who is concerned about this actually do to help derail this momentum?
Well, I'll tell you, as far as America is concerned, for sure, I believe Americans need to get off their lazy duff and get out and clean up their own community. This Agenda 21 program has trickled down to every community in America. Just every one. It's just amazing. It's taken root. It's like a bad case of crabgrass in your lawn. And every community has this. And Americans need to wake up and quit shaking their fist at Washington or whoever they're going to shake their fist at and get out in their local community and kick this stuff out of their community and say, no, we're not going to do this. This is wrong. If there was even 100 communities in America who did that, who really, really cleaned up their own communities and transformed them back where they should be, constitutionally speaking, that would send a message up the food chain that they have a rebellion on their hands. And that's the kind of message we need to send them. I'm afraid it's not going to do any good to go and carry a picket around the street in Paris, France, or anywhere else. But there's a lot we can do on a local basis.
Just to back you up on that, I'm going to throw a link in the show notes to a video, Grassroots Kodiak Defeats Agenda 21-Inspired Zoning, talking about a small town in Kodiak, Alaska that did exactly that. That banded together.
Absolutely, I know that story. It's a fantastic story.
Exactly right. So it can happen. It has happened. It will continue to happen. We have to encourage that process along and help to spread this information to others. On that note, of course, we will direct people once again to technocracyrising.com, the site for your book, as well as technocracy.news, where, as I say, you have you're keeping abreast of this topic and posting articles and editorials on this. Are there any other resources you'd like to direct people to today?
No, you know, I'm kind of throwing all my effort towards technocracy.news right now, just to give people a story that they can read from around the world. I'm personally curating these articles and, you know, picking them out of global journals. Unfortunately, probably 70% of what I post is coming from overseas. Well, to the United States, but that figures. I mean, our press is just horrible here. But, you know, there's just a multitude of things people can read on that website. I'm posting, you know, 3 to 5 articles a day that pertain to this. Some might be climate change, might be sustainable development, it might be the total awareness society, anything related to technocracy I'm putting up there. People need to get the big picture, and they need to see it's real. This is really happening. It's not just people talking about it. It's happening right now.
It really is. And as I say, it's a game for all the marbles, and we are in the end stages of that game. So it's time to get involved in the game if you haven't yet done so. And once again, I'll direct people to Technocracy Rising. Patrick Wood, thank you again for your time today.
Thank you, James. Been really good.